We thank you for listening to the weekly sermon of First United Methodist Church, Missouri City, Texas. We're a church that's making disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. For more information about the church and its ministries, or how we can pray for you, visit us on the web at fumcmc.org. If you desire to make a quick contribution in support of our ministries, you can text to give. Simply text the amount you want to give to 281-369-4870 and follow the instructions. And now, as you listen, we hope that you find this podcast meaningful and transformational in your journey of faith.
Wow. Okay. So, those of you who have ever read Genesis, you know that it starts off with this. Well, you may not know this. It's a beautiful poem. It's a poem written in Hebrew that if you ever hear someone who can speak Hebrew well, ever hear them read it, it is absolutely breathtaking. And the way the Genesis writer described the creation, he did not do it to be used as a book of science or a book of history. See, when the Genesis writer was writing this beautiful poem, what he wanted to stress was this special relationship between God and his creation. I mean, I've said this often, that the most controversial words ever written, ever, in the history of the world were, "In the beginning, God." Controversial because, one, it's the first time anyone thought of a singular, one God. And then, two, it's the first time anyone thought that God would somehow be intimately and personally involved in creation to the point to where he spoke and things were created. And what I love about the poem most of all is at the end of each day what God says. See, because then each day God looks upon what he created and he says, "This is a little better than that." In Hebrew, it would be like you'd be excited. This is good. Except on the sixth day. Because on the sixth day, he created us. If you skip ahead just a few verses and go to chapter 2, you'll see why we were created so well. Because the writer says we are created in the image of God. And so at the end of that day, God said, "Now this isn't just good." He says, "This is good." And it was. And if you read the Genesis story, things are very good. And then things go from very good to not so good. Because this snake comes on the scene, and then there's this apple, and then there's this apple pie, and this biting of the apple pie, and then Adam and Eve realize they're naked. And they hide, and God finds them, and God escorts them very lovingly out of the garden and moves them east. And if you follow the people in Genesis, they go from east to, I guess, Easter to Eastest. Right? And if you read that the way it's supposed to be written, the way it's supposed to be read, is that the further east people move from Eden, the more displaced they become and the farther they are from God. It's a little code language that the Hebrew writer uses. Well, then, what happens when Adam and Eve leave is they go east and they have these two boys, Cain and Abel. And those of you with children, especially two children, know the two or more, know that children are often not the same. Cain and Abel were direct opposites. Connor and Zachary, opposites. Abel was an animal guy. Cain was a farm guy. And the story is told that that one day they both bring their offering to God, right? And Abel's offering is accepted and praised by God, and Cain's offering is rejected by God. And those of you who have two boys, especially two boys who are 27 months apart, you know what happens. There is this competition. There is this ugliness. There is this fighting. In fact, we used to think Zach and Connor were Cain and Abel, and we wondered which one would kill who first, right? And now they're best men at each other's weddings. Go figure. I wish they could have figured it out when they were six. But the same thing happens with Cain. He gets jealous, he gets angry, he gets mad, he gets frustrated, and he lets his temper take charge, and he calls Abel out into the field, and he kills Abel. God comes down. God asks, "What have you done?" Cain says, "What, am I my brother's keeper?" And God punishes him. And if you have your Bibles, open to Genesis 4, because this was like the coolest thing I've discovered in a while. Genesis 4, verse 11, right? And this is God speaking. And God says, "Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." I just got to be honest. When I read that, I circled restless wanderer because it just struck me. Maybe because of the state of mind I've been in lately, maybe because of the state of just kind of where I am, this idea of restless wanderer, and I didn't know what it meant. So I looked in other translations, and I discovered that each translation used a different a phrase for restless wanderer. The NRSV, which is what I usually read, and the Voice calls it a fugitive and a wanderer. King James calls him a fugitive and a vagabond. And the Message, which is not a translation but a paraphrase, just calls him a homeless wanderer. And since I couldn't get an answer of what restless wanderer really meant, I then turned to the Hebrew. And I discovered the writer used two words in Hebrew. He used one word, the first word nua, which is a verb, and it's usually to talk about a displaced person. But it's also used to talk about a person who is shaking or trembling from fear. And then the second word he uses is another verb, nud. And nud is means to flee or to wander, but it's also used to describe a person who is moving about aimlessly without a home. And when I read those two and put them together, someone shaking from fear and wandering aimlessly without a home, I understood. Restless wanderer. Restless soul. That's what he had. And I imagine, those of you who don't know, John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, he never meant to start a church. He just wanted a movement. And the movement that he started had its foundation in small groups, what's called classes. And at the beginning of every class, the leader would look at the class and they would ask them a question. And Wesley expected an honest answer. And the question was very simple: how is it with your soul? That's it. And they would answer. So in my mind, I like to imagine this conversation, because this is how my brain works. Those of you who don't know, it's a little weird. And between Wesley and Cain. Like, if Cain was sitting in Wesley's class and Wesley said to him, "So, Mr. Cain, how is it with your soul?" I would imagine Cain would have to honestly answer, "Well, Mr. Wesley, I have a restless soul. My soul is restless." Andrew did a good job of explaining for the children what a restless soul is. And I want a show of hands, because I don't want anybody lying in church. But I wonder how many of us have ever experienced a restless soul. You know, always searching, but never really finding. You know about that? You know, when your inside is going 100 miles per hour and you find rest for your body somehow, but you can't really find rest for your soul. You ever been there? Restless soul is when you're anxious because someone makes you do the children's time. And you can deal with high schoolers. It's those little kids that drive you crazy, right? A restless soul is when you're worried, when you're tense. A restless soul is when you just don't know how to shut things down. For me, I know my soul is getting restless when I go to bed at night and my body can rest, but the rest of me is just going 90 to nothing again and again and again, thinking, and then it just falls apart. You ever have that, anyone? If you've ever had a restless soul, you're not tired, right? You're just exhausted. It's not a physical tiredness. I love how Richard said it this morning to me, Melissa. Richard described it this way. You're just weary. And it's a horrible feeling. So I did this whole series, How Is It With Your Soul? And the first one, Restless Soul, and there's a reason for that, and we'll find out later maybe. And I started thinking then, if I tell people they have a restless soul, then I have to give them an answer on how to get out of the restless soul, right? And so I try to come up with a very clever answer, because, you know, I don't like preacher answers. Because, you know, the preacher answers are like seven words, and they're cliche-ish, and they're shallow. But I couldn't come up with one. So the only answer I have of how you get rid of a restless soul right now is there is one place and one place only that we find rest for our souls, and that is in God. Now, see, that's just so preachery. It's just so not me to say it like that. So then I turn to Psalms, because who better about restless soul? So David says it like this, Psalm 62. Do we have it? For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. I thought, okay, that's getting a little better. Then I remembered one of the first books I read in seminary was by a guy named Augustine. And it was in a book called Confessions. And you read about his life. It's an autobiography about his life and how he struggled and how he was going from one thing to another, to another, to another, never slowing down, never finding what he was looking for, never finding the peace and the rest that he wanted. And finally, he writes his beautiful prayer that I think you guys already said, but just gorgeous. You have made us for yourself, Lord, and our soul is restless till I find rest in you. And that is gorgeous. It's not original. Like years before Augustine, this guy named Jesus was around. Remember him? And Jesus, Matthew records Jesus saying this in chapter 11. Come to me, all you that are weary and carrying heavy burdens. Anyone here ever carry a heavy burden? Anyone? Just me? Okay, good. And this is what Jesus says. He says, and I will give you rest. And then next verse, he says this. Take my yoke upon you, and never mind, we won't go into that, and learn from me. Do you know what a yoke is? It's not the thing for the ox that preachers show you. That is wrong. When a Jewish rabbi said it was yoke, it's his teaching. It's what he believed at the core of who he was, and for Jesus, the core of who he was love God and love each other. So that's why I said it's easy. Then he says this, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest. Remember the next part? For your souls. So maybe the preacher answer is the right answer. Now, I want to make, a couple weeks ago I preached and I talked about going on in my life, where it seems to me as if God had gone dark, God had gone silent, that I would pray and they would bounce off the ceiling, and other people said they knew exactly what that was, and I want to tell you, what I finally realized is that what I was going through, and maybe still am a little bit, is this restless soul. And when you're in that, not only are you weary, not only are you exhausted, you begin to question things, right? You begin to question whether or not what you're doing is even matters. Is it worth it? Is it making a difference? All this stuff. And you begin, and Richard and Rusty and Allison and Barbara and Martha Girling, they can relate to this, because at some point you begin to actually question your very call, and you start thinking, well, there's something else I can do. I got degrees, more degrees than I know what to do with, right? And that's that restless soul that Augustine was talking about. And I'm telling you that not so I get emails or whatever. I'm telling you that because it's sort of an apology, because what happens to me when I go through a period like that is I become very complacent. I'm a type A ENFP, and when my mind is just kind of going and I'm just bouncing off walls, my natural thing is to just not do anything because I don't want to make a decision to do something. Right? And so the restlessness that I was going to talk about was about that complacency. And it's not good. It hurts your family. It hurts your life. It hurts your soul. And I think the church has suffered because of it, and you know, hopefully we're coming out of that. And because see, I learned that having a restless soul doesn't have to lead to complacency. And you know where I learned that? I was in discussion with Rusty, who's over at the other room, and we started talking about Augustine and about this tension between a restless soul and a restless wanderer. And what I was going through, Bobby, is I was a restless wanderer. See, I think what Augustine was going through was a restless wanderer. Because later, if you read Augustine, you know what you discover? He found rest, but he never stopped. And what Augustine would write later is that it was his restlessness that allowed him to find God on the deeper level that he never dreamed he would ever find God. So maybe restlessness of the soul isn't always bad if we don't let it become restless wandering. See, the difference is, when we're restless in the soul, we have a home. When we're restless wandering like Cain, we're homeless. And what Augustine said is you have a home with God. And when I remember that, all of a sudden, Andrew, restlessness isn't that bad. Because it's what drives us. It is what won't let us settle for something other than the best. It's that thing that makes us wake up in the morning with this passion to change the world, to make a difference, to be the ripple that spreads out. Augustine said that what he discovered is because of his restless soul, right? What he discovered was that he was able to love people better. Because he reached out intentionally and he lived his life, once he embraced it, he lived his life so that other people could taste the love and the grace of God in him. And so I think what's helped me this week is that I decided not to fight the restless soul. I mean, I don't want to be a restless wanderer. But I decided not to fight the restless soul anymore, but to embrace it and to use it to have another life-changing, life-giving encounter with God. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have a church full of restless souls? Right? And I think Tom was brilliant. And I'll never say this again, Tom Tunnel. think Tom was brilliant this morning, because what he said was that's like the difference between being a church goer. How'd you say it, Tom? Going to church and being the church. If you're restless wandering, you're going to church. If you have a restless soul, you're being the church. Not bad, Kay, huh? You didn't think Tom had it in him. Either did we. Wouldn't it be great to have a church full of restless souls? So here's my prayer. Let's make it like a blessing, because it's going to sound more like a blessing. Here's a blessing. May you and I be restless souls. May you and I be restless in our desire to know God more deeply. May you and I be restless in love. Because you see, unless we become restless in love, which means loving those who are different than us, loving those who we have nothing in common with, loving those who we have everything in common with, it means loving like Paul writes in the Philippians, thinking more highly of one another than you do yourself. That's restless in love. And it's only when we live that way can we answer the question, how is it with your soul? And when we're asked that, if we're living the restless soul life, we can sing, it is well. It is well with my soul. That's my prayer for you. I'm going to ask that you stand, and we're going to sing a chorus or two of this. And LaHonda can't be up here singing. She has to be down there. And if there's anyone who wishes to unite with this church, either by letter of profession of faith, this is a time to come forward as we sing a chorus or two of It Is Well. You need to be down there, and Melissa will lead singing or something. And now may the Lord bless you. May the Lord keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. And may the Lord lift up his countenance upon you, give you peace both now and forever. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit go from this place. And may the peace and the love and the grace of God go with you. And may you know, may you remember, may you never forget that there is nothing you can do, nothing that will ever make God love you less. Because when God sees us, he doesn't see the mistakes that we make. He simply says, wow, you're nothing but the best of the best of the best. And can you imagine for just a moment what your day might be like if you lived it believing that? I think you'd have a good day.